Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. I just wanted to put a little reminder out there again that on May 1st, which is a Sunday, I and Jamie DeWolf will be speaking at the Center for Inquiry in Los Angeles, and I'll be doing a book reading and book signing of my book, Scientology A to Xenu, An Insider's Guide to What Scientology is Really All About. So if you're in the LA area or live there or can be there during that weekend, I think it'd be great to meet you. Talk, chat, whatever, you can come by. And I think it's like $8 or something to get in. I think there's a fee or something. Anyway, I'll put the link down below to the event and hope to see you there. So this week, got some interesting questions, so let's go ahead and get to answering them. Quicksilvery. I've heard Scientology referred to as an all-white religion up until it began recruiting from the Nation of Islam. Certainly Hubbard was racist. My question is this: what was it like to emerge from the Scientology bubble into the larger multiracial world? I think there's a little bit of a misconception on this, because Scientology is not exclusively a white Caucasian movement or cult or religion or whatever word you want to use to describe the group. There are people from all over the world in Scientology, from all different cultures, from Indians in India to every mix in Europe, to the United States, Mexico, South America, Thailand, Australia. I mean, Scientology spans all of these areas. They're one of the oldest organizations in Scientology. Was started in Hawaii. I think it was the second or third church they opened after like Los Angeles. So there are certainly, though, no shortage of white people in Scientology. I'm not saying that it's ethnically diverse in correct proportions or something like that. But I never experienced an all-white Scientology. I did, know black people, Chinese people, Indians, different ethnicities in Scientology. Now, what was a shock to me in coming out of Scientology and learning more about the big wide world and that sort of thing was how much of a racist Hubbard was. That I did not know. I didn't actually realize it. I didn't really listen to or see a lot of his material from South Africa. And of course, what we were told when we were in Scientology was exactly the opposite. We weren't given those materials or quotes or information from Hubbard, at least not that I remember. I never saw these things where he was making denigrating statements about black South Africans. We were actually given this line that when he went down to South Africa in Rhodesia in 1966, that he wrote this whole constitution to bring one man, one vote and bring equal rights to Rhodesia, right? And he was going to revolutionize Rhodesia. And in fact, in Scientology, the whole party line is that he was kicked out of Rhodesia because he was making waves with the prime minister and the cabinet members and the government leaders there because of his pro-black South African stance, right? And how he was such a good guy, and they showed photos of when he left, and all of his black South African servants and whatnot were crying and were very upset that he had to leave and this sort of thing. And so we, in Scientology get a very different picture than when you come out of Scientology and you see some of the very, very overtly racist things that Hubbard said that are not, particularly publicized or broadcast in Scientology. There, it's different from the homophobic statements that Hubbard makes and the anti-LGBT stuff that he says in Dianetics and in Science of Survival, where his whole take on it is that those are mental illnesses and or what he calls aberrations or perversions, and how those people need to be done away with, right? He's much more overt about that class of people. But when it came to race, there's a lot of things in Scientology that that Scientologists read, like the Creed of the Church and things like that, right? Or the Way to Happiness, right? The precepts of the Way to Happiness, where you interpret those to mean equality for everybody. And that racism doesn't really spread around within Scientology. Hubbard's racism was something I was not particularly aware of. So anyway, just wanted to comment on that. Mr. Marathon 1989. Chris, aren't most, if not all, of the gains in Scientology just a placebo response? Well, strictly speaking, I don't think that you would call Scientology processing or training a placebo, because by definition, a placebo is a knowingly administered fake medicine or pill or treatment that you know is you know, not going to have any effect. And yet there's this thing called the placebo effect, where people can seem to or actually do get better, or at least a certain percentage of people who are given placebos seem to overcome illnesses or problems they're having as a result of that. I don't think that all of Dianetics and Scientology work by a placebo effect, because there are methods, there are things that are done in Scientology and in Dianetics that have a degree of workability when it comes to therapy, right, or rehabilitation of a person mentally or emotionally. Some of the procedures have, on a certain percentage of the population, and not just the placebo percentage, I think there's a different percentage we're talking about, and this is all just my opinion, but I believe that there are some people who do get some true mental or psychological or emotional help and recovery from past traumatic experiences or things that have happened to them as a result of some of the procedures of Dianetics and Scientology. Now, the reason why I am so blatantly, you know, like, look, don't do it, is because I believe that those same effects and results can be gotten more easily and more openly and without the cost-benefit analysis. You know, is pretty heavy in Scientology, right? Because of all of the authoritarian and dictatorial trappings and the you know, the covert hypnotism and the ethics and all the other things that go along with Scientology that make it a destructive cult. Those things are part of the whole mix. You when you go to a Church of Scientology or to a Dianetic Center, you're getting the whole package. You're not just getting the good parts. And this is where I, you know, just go, no, just don't go there. It's not worth it. Getting that little bit of benefit, or potentially being one of the percentage of people who are going to get some benefit out of it, is not worth all of the cost that you have to pay to get that. When there's other places you can go, therapists, you know, other more open workshops and books you can read and things like that. I mean, there's lots of places you can get mental and emotional help, or, you know, psychological help without having to go through all of the nonsense that Scientology puts you through. I mean, way, way, way more other places. So that's why I'm not saying none of it works. And I've never said that. I'm saying that a very, very small percentage of it works, does something, doesn't do what it promises it's going to do. None of it does what it promises it's going to do. And that's what I mean. There's so many layers of deception to it that you have to put so many qualifiers on it. When I say it will help, you know, I have to qualify this with this and this and this and this. And that's why I just go, you know, just forget it. Just don't go. You know, go do something else, and you'll get the same benefits without all the nonsense. So, but, you know, in the end, no, I don't believe it's all just placebo response. Doug Nichols, what are your thoughts on the gun culture of America? Why do Americans hang on to the Second Amendment to justify mass shootings and the entitlement of gun ownership? What can your great country do to go in another direction? It was a pretty different question, but I thought it would be good to talk about something new and different here. We tend to comment on this sort of thing on my podcast more often. I think that the United States was founded on a rebellion, right, against England. I think that the United States has always had a tradition of strong, fierce independence, personal freedom, personal independence, and it's kind of the whole culture of America, and has been for the last couple of centuries, like I said, you know, since it was founded. So since you have this strong personal idealism and independent thought, there's a lot of, it's very easy to create a very anti-government sentiment, which doesn't seem to exist in other countries. Now, I haven't lived in other countries. My experience of other countries, you know, Europe or Canada or Mexico or any other country in the world, you know, are based on secondhand experience from what I've been told by people who are from those places. But I get that they're very different, you know, that they consider they're not as necessarily distrusting of their government, or there's more of a cooperative effort in some places, right? And there's a lot of propaganda that comes into the United States about that, right? Especially about Sweden and Norway and, you know, Scandinavian countries and the socialisms and how great they are and that sort of thing, right? Higher taxes, but you get all these benefits and all this sort of thing. And we could talk about that kind of stuff all day long, but Americans have an almost inbred distrust of authority, right? When it comes to governments, at least, they do, right? And so there's always this idea, this play back and forth between the government's services and what the government does for you versus what the government's doing to you. And people, rightly or wrongly, perceive that guns and personal gun ownership are their only personal defense against that. I don't happen to follow that line of reasoning. I think that, you know, the democratic process and civil discourse and laws and things like that are certainly a wall of a line of defense for us. And I think and wish that more people would engage in that part of the process more, despite all of its, you know, definitely despite all of its noted shortcomings and difficulties and the slowness of the process and that sort of thing. And of course, then we have the Second Amendment, which pretty clearly states that, you know, and is easy to interpret as saying that, you know, because we don't totally trust the government, because we had to rebel in order to have the United States at all, we're always going to be in this state of readiness against the government and, you know, and have the state militia sort of thing, right? And I think some people get a little bit creative and exaggerated in their interpretations of that when they're carrying guns around in Walmart or Subway. I think we've gone, you know, a little bit nutso with that. You know, I don't think it has any place. I don't think walking around with guns is any kind of a solution to a civilized society. So I think in terms of, you know, what would it take to turn the ship and move in a different direction, I think it would take a whole lot of propaganda. I think it would take a whole lot of work on the, you know, like, what did it take to make cigarettes, you know, go from a hip, cool, good thing to be doing, which it was in the 1940s and 50s, to what it is now, where it's a bad thing and people are, you know, it's like mainly, you know, look at smokers in disgust, right, for the most part. And recognize that smoking is dangerous. Like, it's actually really not good for you. And 50 years ago, people really didn't think that. Well, we've got 300 years to overcome of, you know, gun rights in the United States. And there are sensible reasons to have guns. So it's not that I think everybody who, you know, is a Second Amendment advocate or supports guns is a gun nut or something, because there are logical, sensible reasons for gun ownership. But I think and wish that the people who were so pro-Second Amendment could could see the other side of the reasoning too, and kind of give some ground on it, because it gets so extremist. In certain circles, it gets so extremist that logic has just taken a back seat to emotional feelings. So I think it was going to take a long-term propaganda, you know, PR campaign of some kind to raise our children. And, you know, I think it's going to take a generation or two or three to raise our children with the idea that guns aren't necessary for personal freedom, that the government is not necessarily something that is inherently bad or twisted or corrupted or evil, even though there's lots and lots and lots, again, of good reasons to see where there is corruption and there is evil and there is, you know, people taking advantage of the system. You know, we live in the world we live in. And if we don't like it, we need to do something to change it, you know. So I think that's what people need to do, and I think that's what it's going to take to change the idea of how important personal gun ownership is in the United States, because we're pretty fanatical about it, no question about it. There's fanaticism on the subject, and that fanaticism needs to be dealt with through education of generations. It's a multi-generational education. So that's what I think. Mojo Risen. Hi, Chris. As a critical thinker, what is your opinion on the legalization of marijuana? Also, has there ever been an incident involving a Sea Org member caught smoking or possessing weed or any other illegal drug? All right, so no, I've never seen in the 17 years that I was in the Sea Org, I never saw a Sea Org member busted for owning pot or using illicit substances or illegal drugs. Not once. Scientology prides itself on being a drug-free group, and for the most part, they really are. You know, very, very, very few Scientologists that I ever ran into in all the years that I was in went back to drugs or did drugs, and no one I knew in Scientology was ever somebody who was addicted to drugs as a Scientologist, right? I mean, like very, very few times did I see somebody who used to be on drugs fall off the wagon and have to go get, you know, help. And of course, the help they got usually was through Narcanon, and sometimes that worked and sometimes it didn't. So that's my experience with that, Scientology-wise. In terms of my opinion of marijuana legalization, I'm all for it. I live in the state of Colorado where it is legal. I've seen really no indication in my day-to-day life here of negative repercussions of the legalization of marijuana. In fact, I've seen a lot of positive changes or consequences of it when it's not criminalized. There's a lot of reasons for it. I'm not an expert on the subject, but I know because it has medicinal uses that are extremely valid, totally real, that's a good reason right there to legalize marijuana. And in fact, that's how California is doing it, Washington, D.C., right? I think Oregon. So I think it's kind of, at this point, a foregone conclusion that it eventually will be legal across the United States. Because Colorado and Washington State, I think, have been sort of the pilot states. You know, let's do it there and see how it works. And there's still a lot of federal problems because it's illegal federally. So, you know, there's all kinds of rigmarole going on with people who sell pot here totally legally, but they can't be insured, they can't have a checking account because it's insured by the federal government, and the federal government won't insure drug money. I mean, it just, you know, it just kind of goes round and round. So I think we need to get past that and just legalize it. And I think that also, you know, going back and maybe, you know, like I see what I've seen, I think very recently, like within the last week or two, is I've seen some efforts being made to maybe even, you know, declassify it down as in the drug category. So it's not classified as such a dangerous drug because, you know, it's not that big of a deal if, you know, like anything done properly and in moderation, you know, it's not gonna kill you. So that's my take on it from my own personal experience. Haven't done a lot of study of it. Haven't read a lot of papers on it or anything, but that's what I think from living in a state where it is legal. Billy Bob. Boko Haram and arguably ISIS, the Taliban, and other Islamist groups seemingly have all the indicators and fit the pattern of destructive cults. Do you agree? Will the elimination of the leaders of such cults disrupt the cult enough to break up the organization, or will another leader arise? Do cults, once established, require autocratic leadership to survive as a group? Will the true believers in their need that the organization continue accept whoever acquires that leadership position, no matter how ill-gotten? Isn't a yes answer to the previous questions kind of scary? All right, a lot of questions here. In a nutshell, like, yes, I do believe that those groups that you're talking about, the Islamist extremist groups, are destructive cults. Yes, I do think that. I think they have all the earmarks of destructive cults. Centralized power and a leader who cannot be questioned, black and white thinking, us versus them mentality, very extreme idealism to the point where you have to give your entire life to the cause, literally give your life to the cause. All of these things are earmarks of destructive cults, and these extremist groups meet those. Now, the leaders of these groups, it depends on the group and the cells and the organization of it. I can't give a broad answer to if you take out the leader of one of these groups, is it instantly going to all collapse? It's hard to say, because in groups like those, there are people who step up when, authority figures are taken down. And it's not always just one leader, right? Destructive cults don't have to center on an individual. They can center on a group or a core group of leaders instead. A council, things like that, right? Like, look at the Jehovah's Witnesses. They have a governing body. Originally, they had, the first guy, and then he was succeeded by another guy, Rutherford, and then he was succeeded by a council of people who've been running that show for decades. So it's not always just in one figure. Cult members are, by definition, people who are bowing to or acceding to or giving authority to somebody else to run their life. So that's why it is scary, but it is a fact of life that when you're in a position like that, you are going to bow to the next leader, right? Scientology-wise, if David Miscavige disappears tomorrow, well, we're sort of wondering what's going to happen. If somebody else steps up, it will continue, Now, whether somebody is going to step up or not is the big question with Scientology. But with these groups, there's no end to the number of people who are willing to step up and run these extremist groups, right? And it's not just Islamist extremist groups either. Your question asks about them, but these extremist groups occur in all nationalities across the globe. And if you familiarize yourself with the symptom or with the characteristics of a destructive cult, you will see instances of them all around. I mean, there really are. And I don't mean to get paranoid and say there's destructive cults everywhere. I'm not saying everything is a destructive cult, but you see indications of it. You see signs of it. You see how groups can become extremist groups. And so you find here in the United States, religious factions, political factions, even sports factions can become cult-like groups or can literally become destructive cults in themselves. So all these questions apply to those just as easily. So that's how that kind of works. It's time for Flash Answers. Adam Robitaille. Hey Chris, quick question for you. Do you know if any military personnel could also be Scientologists? Would the Church of Scientology allow it? Absolutely. I met lots of people when I was in Scientology who were also in the military. And they would go off. I met guys who were reservists who were in Scientology, and I met active duty people who were Scientologists. And there's the Scientology has nothing on it. What they do have something on is when somebody has a security clearance in the military, or they have ties to intelligence agencies like the FBI or the CIA or the NSA, that is kind of a no-no in Scientology. They get nervous about that sort of thing because, For obvious reasons, the FBI, CIA have investigated Scientology in the past, and, you know, not in the recent past, not just back in when Hubbard was around. So Scientology has a real chip on its shoulder about those agencies and anybody connected with them. Jennifer Isaacs, do you ever think someday there will be sects of Scientology, or is that still considered being squirrely, whatever that means? There are sects of Scientology, not official Scientology, but the squirrely thing you're talking about was Hubbard's attempt to keep splinter groups from happening in Scientology, starting back in the 50s and 60s, was to label anybody who broke away from the official line, his brand of Scientology, was labeled a squirrel, right? Which Hubbard was using as a derogatory term to say that they're just chasing after nuts and they're just running around on a, you know, on a squirrel wheel or a hamster wheel or something, right? Not getting anywhere. And he was real, you know, death on that. He did not like people splintering off and taking his work and using it without paying him, because, you know, remember, it's all about the Benjamins. But every independent Scientology field group that exists now is a sect of Scientology, is a splinter group from Scientology. Unless I'm using that word wrong, that's what they are. And they have names, you know, they'll call themselves independent Scientologists or Free Zone or this or that, but that's what they are. Andy Lesser. Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for continuing to put out such high-quality videos. I hope this isn't too personal a question, but I was wondering what it is that you do for work now that you are out of the Sea Org. I would assume that your work on Scientology and critical thinking is supplemental to another source of income, but I could be wrong. You have spoken before about how the Sea Org helped give you many career skills, such as public speaking. In the work you do now, both the YouTube podcast work and also any other work you might do, what other skills that you learned in Scientology have you been bringing to bear? Thank you so much for answering and wishing you continued luck in all you do. Okay, well, real fast, I am a videographer and a motion animator and graphic designer, and I have my own company, and that's what I do for work, and I have clients, and I do work for them. But I'm a YouTube creator, and I'm a writer. Right, I've written a book. I'm gonna write another one this year, and those are my primary jobs. Really, that's what I consider is my primary work is this, and I'm more than happy and feel very lucky to be doing this. And I bring every skill that I ever learned in the Sea Org from public speaking to video work and graphic design work and copywriting and everything. To bear on what I do. I just use it all the time. So that's kind of how I get along in life. And I, like I said, I consider myself very lucky to be able to do this full time with a lot of support from you folks. To be totally honest, this is the only reason that I'm able to keep doing what I'm doing like this is because of you guys. So thank you very much. And please continue. All right, so we've reached the end of another episode of our Critical Q&A. Thank you very much for coming around. I also hope to see you guys at the Reason Rally, by the way, on June 4th. Me and my podcast partner, Ruth, will be in Washington, D.C. For that weekend, and we'll be celebrating logic, reason, and critical thinking. And so if you're in that area, look us up. We'll be around there, and very much would like to meet you all out there. So until next week, thank you very much. Leave any comments, questions, or feedback below, and I'll talk to you soon.